Today is Sunday, October 1st, 2023. This is part 6 of a Grand Canyon oral history with Peter Huntoon. Peter spells his last name H-U-N-T-O-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Peter. How are you today?
Very good.
Great. Peter, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. In our last visit, you had taken us out to the west side of Grand Canyon, talked about the helicopters and you used and the gasoline and transport back and forth. Can you sort of go up to the 30,000 foot level for a minute and sort of talk about your thesis and what was going on there?
Okay, yeah, I think it's a good idea to give a big picture of this thing. The Grand Canyon, as most people know, is eroded into a thing called the Colorado Plateau. And the Colorado Plateau is a huge area that encompasses the northeast corner of Arizona, southwest corner of Utah, southeast corner of Colorado, and northeast corner of New Mexico.
Okay.
So it's a huge area.
Big area.
And this thing is comprised primarily of flat-lying sedimentary rocks. And the top 4,500 feet of them in the Grand Canyon are consist of limestones at the top, some sandstones and shales in the middle, and limestones mostly at the bottom.
Okay.
And the Grand Canyon is incised into this pile of rock. Now, we've got this 4,500 feet of sedimentary rock there, and the Grand Canyon is a little over a mile deep, so it cuts all the way through those.
Okay.
Okay, now that's the geology that I'm interested in. The thing is, when we look at the Colorado Plateau, there are virtually no live surface streams on it. And that's peculiar for an area that huge.
So hang on, Peter, what do you mean by a live surface stream?
What I mean is a stream that flows all year round over the land surface.
Okay.
And you can drive for miles across the Colorado Plateau and never see one.
Hmm.
The only big one is the Little Colorado River, and that doesn't make it all the way to the Grand Canyon most of the time.
Right.
Now, the problem is, or not the problem, but the reality is that there's enough rainfall to produce these kind of streams, but they don't exist. So what we find is that the water infiltrates through the sedimentary rocks, and it shows up in springs in the deep canyons, like
okay.
the Grand Canyon.
Hmm.
So that's a peculiar situation. Now, the thing is that we want to understand that, and what my thesis was involved in was trying to explain what localized the springs at the bottom of the canyons, and particularly the Grand Canyon. And the other thing is once we got done understanding that, then we would try to subdivide the plateaus that surround the Grand Canyon and the other deep canyons into catchment areas that feed particular springs.
Okay.
So that was the two-part objective of the
okay. So hang on a second. Let me make sure I understand this. So the first part is to locate the springs,
right?
And look at the geology that is at the springs. Like, is there a fault? Is there a fold? Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Okay. And then the second part is, okay, we understand where this spring is and the local geology. Now, what's happening in the bigger picture around it, geographically?
Exactly.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, exactly. So what happens is, when we looked at the springs, we realized that most of them were localized along fault zones.
Okay.
So we realized that, okay, we've got fracture systems that are feeding these springs. Now, the important thing about those fractures is that you can trace them for a long distance on the land surface, but the other important thing is they fracture the rocks between the top of the plateaus and the bottom of the pile of rocks, and it allows the water to find roots down through the rocks to the bottom of the canyon.
Okay.
So we got that two-part image. So obviously, what I had to do for my thesis, and I figured this out really early on, is I had to map those fracture zones. And that would help me understand the circulation systems that were feeding the springs.
Okay.
Once we mapped them out, then I could delineate the areas that drained a particular fault zones, and then we could subdivide the surrounding plateaus into catchment areas that fed the given springs.
Okay, so if so you would maybe follow a fault either on the map or on the ground, and then look at the tilt of the rocks either side of the fault and say, okay, well, this rock is tilting toward me, down toward me, so its catchment must be up there, up on that tilted bed further away from me.
Right.
Sort of a simple way to understand that. Okay.
Okay, so I started this work for my master's. I worked on the west side of the Kaibab Plateau. The Kaibab Plateau is a big chunk of land, and for my PhD, I did everything on the north side of the Eastern Grand Canyon. Okay, now what we're talking about in that realm is we're probably talking about 1,500 square miles or something like that I was worrying about when I was working on my PhD thesis.
Okay.
And so and that was everything north of the river up to the Utah line. And the thing that I paid particular attention to was the Kaibab Plateau, because the Kaibab Plateau is the highest of the plateaus in the Grand Canyon vicinity at about 8,000 or 9,000 feet, and it gets up to 30 inches of rain. And so we've got plenty of water up there. We've got a beautiful ponderosa forest on top of the Kaibab Plateau.
Right.
Yet there's no surface streams up there.
Right.
So all this stuff is going through the groundwater system. And as we've talked about before, we found out that it infiltrates the surface, moves to the faults, goes down the faults, and out along the faults to the springs. And the way it does that is it follows caves in the upper part of the section and also at the bottom of the section to get out.
Okay.
And so we're looking at cave systems that are tens of miles long that feed these springs. So this is big-time stuff, and rivers come out some of these springs.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the idea. Now, what happened was I was working as a student on this thing, and of course I had no money and no budget to speak of. I had a small grant of $1,500 a summer from the Museum of Northern Arizona, so I had nothing to work with. But so I was going by the seat of my pants. I was able to delineate all this stuff and do that on a starvation diet, but I didn't have any other resources available to me to continue the work.
Hmm.
What was really great, now this we're talking about the 1960s now.
Yep.
What's really great is about 55 years later, something like that, the National Park Service puts together a hydrology team, and this was led by a guy named Ben Tobin. And what they asked those guys to do was to test my conclusions.
Ooh.
And see if I got it right.
Wow.
And this is the greatest thing going, because what they did is they decided to do dye tracing. And what they did is they went up on the Kaibab Plateau. They found sinkholes that fed the system. Now, these are dry. They waited until it snowed. They put dye in the sinkholes. When the snow melted, it took the dye down, and it mapped out these flow systems.
Wow.
And that was dramatic work. And they started this dye tracing work, and what they found out was that the water was typically taken a couple of months to get through the system, because they were looking at slow recharge and base flow type conditions.
Okay.
But it popped out at the springs. They had sampling at the mouths of the springs. They collected samples, and they could see the dye come through.
Wow.
And so they did this. And I was absolutely tickled to see this work come along, because, of course, it was a test of my hypotheses.
Yes.
And, you know, the great thing in a thing like this is, are you going to sink or swim?
Right.
And, fortunately, the luck was with me, and the stuff worked out to demonstrate that what I had delineated was actually the way the system worked.
Wow, now, that's awesome.
Why do you care about something like this? Well, the reason you care about it is that one of the big springs in the Grand Canyon, Roaring Spring, is the water source for the entire park.
Right.
So what they want to know is where that water is coming from so that they can protect the land surface above it from contamination, for example.
Okay. Yep.
And so, for example, around the Grand Canyon, there are uranium deposits. Well, you want to know where they are and where the groundwater is circulating so that you can mitigate impacts if they start mining them. That kind of thing. The other thing you don't want to do is have inappropriate developments up on the surface that can pollute the land surface and wash into the groundwater system and contaminate the water supply.
Okay.
And this work that we were doing for my thesis was north of the Grand Canyon. As our project started expanding in size and the park contracted us to map the geology, we were also looking at the hydrology at the same time. And one area that we spilled over onto was the Supai Native American Reservation on the south side of the canyon.
Okay.
In Cataract Canyon.
Okay.
And that was an area where the Supais are using a spring that's coming out of the base of the limestones, and that's their water supply. They live down there, and upstream from them is a big drainage basin called the Cataract Drainage Basin.
Very large.
Yeah, it's large. It's several hundred square miles, and that feeds that spring, and they do indeed have a uranium mine up on that drainage basin. And they're very concerned about, is it feeding the groundwater system? And, more importantly, how fast?
Got it.
And what we found out through observation was, is that it takes, if they have a flood coming down through a cataract basin, flood in terms of a major storm event or a big snow melt, it takes about 2 years for water that infiltrates at the upstream end of the basin to reach their springs.
Okay.
Well, that's fast.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about a distance of about 20 to 30 miles. So you're talking about the water moving through the aquifer 30 miles or 20 miles in 2 years.
Wow. Okay.
That means that if you put something up there, it's going to come out in the form that you put it in. It's just a big deal. And this work has resulted in some decisions, and just recently the federal government has withdrawn most of that area from uranium mining to protect the tribe and other users in the Grand Canyon region.
Right.
So this has a practical application. Okay, now that's the big picture.
So hang on, is that, you know, the president just came out with Secretary of Interior and dedicated a new national monument using the Antiquities Act called Bajnawajo, and on the south side and the north side of the park, and or of the Grand Canyon, I should say, it's BLM and Forest Service land. Was that in part based on some of this work?
Yeah. So some of the big push came from these findings. Yeah, exactly. Now, realize that, of course, I pioneered in this work.
Mm-hmm.
Other people have followed up. So, there's a lot of people involved in this thing. But the basic picture is the picture that we laid out for them.
Nice.
In terms of the geologic framework. They had to have that information to make their correct interpretations.
Okay.
And then they took some of the results, and they've taken some statements I've made, and they used that in the decision-making. But I don't claim that I was responsible for that. I was just one of the people that added to that decision-making process. But I think that we offered a critical piece of the puzzle that they needed to have in place to make an informed decision.
And it's interesting that ties together with the work that was done for the 1975 Enlargement Act of Grand Canyon, which looked at the greater Grand Canyon and all its neighbors, trying to get them to work together on a unified vision of interpretation. And so it's interesting to see how the watershed feeds into that, or that unified interpretation of the land is based on the watershed and the geology.
Yeah, that's right.
Very cool.
Now, okay, so this is old history. I'm finished with my thesis in 1970, which is 53 years ago, right?
Yep.
And you know, I can hardly remember this stuff. But the deal is once we finish my dissertation, then the park contracts with us to make the Eastern Grand Canyon map. We take a couple of years to do that, a few years to do that. Then we do the Western Grand Canyon. Simultaneously, as we're working in the Western Grand Canyon, we're going right over the Hualapai Indian Reservation, which lies south of the Colorado River,
yep,
adjacent to the Grand Canyon. And that's a group of people that has a chronic water shortage.
Yes.
And they got given some really rotten land out there, and they're having a hard time with it. Well, anyway, as we were doing the geology, the Water Resources Institute at the University of Wyoming was also supporting a hydrologic look at the Hualapai Plateau, where we did the same thing that we did in the Kaibab Plateau.
Huh.
We subdivided the Hualapai Plateau into drainage basins that fed specific springs along the Grand Canyon on their land, and they have been looking at that and other groundwater prospecting opportunities that we identified as potential water supplies. And that's in a very early stage of development, but I understand that pretty soon they're going to be moving forward with using water from some of those springs for their needs. The big issue is, for them, is that just like at the Grand Canyon, if the stuff comes out at the bottom, they got to pump it 4,500 feet up to get it to their village.
That's right.
And that's a big, you know, that's a big expense.
Yeah.
But anyway, we'll have to see what unfolds in the future.
So it's interesting, when I think of the Hualapai Reservation is fairly large, down toward I-40, all the way up to the south, to and along the south bank of the river, as the initial tribal legislation states, the springs that I think about, well, National has year-round water, and just sort of working my way downstream, Three Springs has year-round water. I mean, a flow that is maybe, you know, a cubic feet a second. I mean, we're talking about small flows here. There's nothing that's, you know, Travertine Grotto and Travertine Falls. There's a springs there, Diamond Creek. So there's a number of drainages that have some water in them. There's a lot of drainages that don't.
Yeah, well, the big ones, the ones that count, going from east to west.
Okay.
Is the Head of Diamond has a good spring.
Yep.
A few cubic feet per second. Then we jump over to Milkweed Spring, which is a cubic foot per second or something like that, and that used to have a village right in front of it.
Ah.
And then we go out further to the west.
So Milkweed, is that Spencer, Marowitica?
Yeah, Spencer,
okay,
and Marowitica Canyon.
All
they,
right.
There's two or three springs up there that
yeah,
are good.
Yeah,
and they give you a perennial flow down.
I forgot about mentioning that, yep.
Right, and then we get out to, what's that waterfall?
Columbine
yeah,
Falls, that's
Columbine
right.
Columbine Falls.
Okay.
And what's the next one down? You know, the one right at the mouth of the canyon. It comes out of the Rampart Fall up there.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking is Columbine.
That's Columbine.
It's in Cave Canyon, I think is the name of it. Yeah.
Now, one of the things that's sad is that the Columbine Spring is localized on the Rampart Fault, which goes for about 20 miles south of there, right along the rim of the Colorado Plateau. And at the headwaters, it's nicely faulted up. And I wrote an article one time that that looked like a good groundwater prospect. They could drill a well up there if they wanted to go down a few thousand feet. Maybe they'd hit water in the Redwall.
Okay.
Well, that was one of those situations where somebody actually followed up on it. They drilled the well. They started, they found the water. And what they found was it had natural uranium contamination and you couldn't use it for
anything. Wow.
Yeah, that's a, you know, that's a problem.
Yep.
But anyway, you know, at least they found some water. So we were proven to understand what was going on. It just didn't turn out to be any good.
And I think the Hawaii just recently had legislation in their favor through Congress, which allows them to build a pipeline down Diamond Creek Road to the river to extract Colorado River water into a pipeline system to get up all the way over to the Skywalk and to Peach Springs and bring some water to the reservation. So that's pretty cool. And I would imagine that the amount of water that they can draw is based in part on the amount of water that comes into the Colorado River from these springs on tribal land.
Yeah, if I had my say about it, I'd have to have them pipe it out of Diamond Creek because you wouldn't even need to treat the water.
That's
clean water.
Yeah, that's pipe it out of Diamond Creek. Oh,
yeah,
I see.
The spring, from the spring up there. But anyway,
You
know, that's a technical detail that means nothing.
Yeah, I think they're assuming that if they pump it out of the Colorado River, they're guaranteed a flow. Well, of course, there's all kinds of problems with what's happening upstream there and dams and such not. So anyway, it's way above my pay grade. They figured that out.
But, okay, now let me set the stage for you just a bit on another thing.
Okay.
Once we got done with the Grand Canyon map, of course, other national parks were interested in similar mapping. And the areas that we covered, the Eastern Grand Canyon map that we worked on covered 1,800 square miles.
Wow.
Then George Billingsley and I and a couple of other people who were working on a Precambrian did the Western Grand Canyon. That was 2,600 square miles. So we're talking about a big bite here. The next project we won was at Canyonlands. They wanted a map, and that was 2,100 square miles. And that was followed by Capitol Reef, which was 1,800 square miles. So we're talking about big chunks of real estate, and we were mapping this stuff at either the scale of 1 to 48, 1,000 or 1 to 62.5. Billingsley gets himself in the USGS and he starts mapping on a more regional scale, a 1 to 100,000 scale.
Oh, wow.
And he starts moving through all the big maps that surround the Grand Canyon. That was his life goal. I'll tell you what that guy mapped. He mapped 18,000 square miles during his career.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, this is about as big time as you can get. And I think that's quite an accomplishment.
Absolutely.
For a guy.
That's amazing. 18,000 square miles.
Okay.
Wow. Got to ponder that. Well, so we have some things to talk about here in the future, now that being Canyonlands and Capitol Reef. Let's back up a little bit. You mentioned that you passed your defense and graduated a doctorate in hydrology, I suppose. Is that right?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
At the University of Arizona.
And the jobs were scarce.
Yeah, there were no jobs in 1970.
But there was a job at the University of Nebraska.
Right.
And I'm just thinking, wow, you've just come out of river trips in Grand Canyon, and you've been hiking all over the place and flying around in a helicopter. I don't think life gets much more exciting than that. And when I think of Nebraska, I think of a flat country with lots of corn, and the geology there is kind of quiet. How did you survive out there?
Well, I'll tell you, I moved from Arizona to Nebraska, and it was a culture shock. It's as simple as that. Like you say, the geology is very straightforward. There's not much to it. One thing that got me the job there was that I had learned to make digital models of aquifers to predict impacts if you pumped them.
Huh.
And this was a new technology. They were interested in employing this stuff. So when I got there, the first thing they wanted me to do was make assessments of these major areas in Nebraska where they were pumping the Ogallala Aquifer.
Okay.
And they were experiencing very serious groundwater level declines in the Ogallala, and this was starting already in the 1970s.
Wow.
To impact land values, because of course you were growing corn on this stuff, and if you couldn't irrigate the corn, you had to go to wheat, and that really cut your income. So they were starting to see the impacts of water withdrawals from these aquifers. So I got assigned that, and the first place I worked was a place called the Blue River Basin, and we covered, I don't know, a couple of, maybe 1,000 square miles of that. I don't know how much of it. But we made a digital model of that and simply modeled different development scenarios, including leaving it just the way it was and making predictions on how fast the water levels would drop.
Okay.
And so this is all computer work. I'm going from field work out in the Grand Canyon to sitting in an office, you know, writing computer code.
Wow.
That was a big shift in my life. But anyway, the thing was, this was very interesting work, and it was a real terrific professional opportunity for me to, you know, expand my horizons. And we cranked out the work there.
So I'm thinking, hang on a second, I want to ponder this for a minute. You and I talked about your early computer work at the University of Arizona using differential equations and punch cards. Did Nebraska have, were they starting to migrate away from punch cards when you were there?
Well, yeah, we gradually got away from them. I was right there on the cusp of the transition.
Okay.
And yeah, that was just a little technical flick. That was no big deal. But you had to, you know, you just had to learn that stuff.
Yeah, you had to know how. Were you writing code? Were you using COBOL, or what sort of code were you using?
What I was using was a language called Fortran, That was a good scientific language at that time.
Okay.
And the curious thing about that Fortran is that I still use it to this day to do processing. It's a valuable language.
Cool.
Anyway.
Cool.
Yeah, that was fun. When I worked in Nebraska, the Blue River model that I made, if you put it on punch cards, took two boxes of punch cards. A couple thousand of them.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was great fun stuff.
And it would take a day to run or something like that?
Well, using the hottest computer we had at the time, it took about 15 to 20 minutes to run a simulation.
Wow, okay.
Now you could do it on your PC in less than a minute.
Yeah, no, your smarty pants phone.
Yeah, and we were using big computers, and now you got that in a, you know, you can practically put the whole thing in a watch. It's amazing.
In a laptop, yeah, whatever. It's small.
Anyway,
yeah.
So life in Nebraska was very sedate.
How did you keep your sanity? I mean, just the change to you physically, not even talking mentally. I mean, from being hale and hearty and able to hike around here and there and climb this and that, to sort of sit in an office under fluorescent lights all day long.
Well, what we did and the way we handled it was George and I were still taking these contracts to map.
Okay.
So we were working up Canyonlands during that period.
Okay.
And the Conservation and Survey Division, where I worked, they actually did the drafting for us for the Canyonlands map.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that was a terrific, bonus of working there. They were very good about that.
So did you do it the same way? You had a Mylar sheet and had the topographic maps on the one side of the Mylar, and then you would have the geology on the other?
Yeah, that's exactly the way we did it.
Okay.
And then we sent that Mylar off to Williams and Hines Corporation, and they printed the map. So that was a tremendous bonus of working there. So, yeah, I was getting out to the Grand Canyon on all my vacations and stuff like that.
Okay.
And we were working up that data. And
did you get Bill Breed to do your color scheme for Canyonlands?
He was involved, yes. And that map didn't turn out to be as sexy looking as the Grand Canyon map, but it's a beautiful map, I'll tell you. That was Bill's primary involvement. And Bill was helping us land those contracts. Bill worked very carefully with us to get the contracts at Canyonlands and also at Capitol Reef.
Okay, and so did the funds go from the NPS to M&A and then out to you guys?
Yeah, that's the way we did it.
Okay.
Now, the thing is, we were operating just about the same on those as we were when we were working in the Grand Canyon. We were only getting small grants, and these grants were on the order of thousands of dollars. They were just enough to feed you, and so we were really doing this on the cheap.
Mm.
And, of course, it was being subsidized by the organizations that we were working for, me with the Conservation Survey Division, George with the USGS. And before George joined the USGS, he operate as a river guide for Grand Canyon Expeditions out of Kanab, Utah.
Right.
And that was his employer for a couple of years. And we're doing all this geology as an add-on to this stuff.
Got it. And George wasn't making a lot of money as a river guide because you just don't. It's just seasonal employment. You're out of work all winter.
Yeah, you know, in those days, George and I were pretty thin. But, you know, it was a perfect life. For George, it was perfect because he was on the river all the time, and he could field check stuff. And, of course, one of the things that, if you look at what we were doing, we moved from the Grand Canyon to Canyonlands. Well, what we were doing was really going to all the great parks that had big reaches of the Colorado River so we could do some of our work with the rafts. And we did that.
And, course, and that's we Cataract working. Canyon, so that would have been fun.
Yeah, the Cataract Canyon is one of the greatest. I mean, that thing, in my opinion, is the toughest bunch of rapids I ever got into.
Well, there's a lot of people that agree with you.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing was is that George had access to the rafts, and as he got in with Grand Canyon Expeditions, he would occasionally take me on a river trip with him.
Huh.
And what I'm doing is I'm watching, and I'm figuring, maybe I can do this. So by the time we started working in the Western Grand Canyon, we had to have river access. I had to have it,
okay.
And I couldn't be doing it off of commercial rigs, obviously.
Right.
So I had to buy a couple of rafts to get the job done myself.
What kind of rafts did you buy?
I got two Avon Spirits, which were 18 feet by about, 10 or so feet wide. And they were, I learned about these from Art Gallinson, who worked for the Grand Canyon Expeditions. He used to love to talk equipment. And when I was up there visiting George, I talked to him, and Art was telling me that, you know, for what you're doing, maybe these Avon Spirits, which are the Cadillac of the small boats,
yep,
they're just big enough to do the Western Grand Canyon.
Okay.
And I said, okay. So I bought two of them. One of them in the winter of 75 and the next one in the spring of 76, and we put them on the water. And
Who'd you buy them from?
Well, there was a place in California that sold these things.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it was, well, right. It was, I'll think of it, one of the names was Aquamarine. That was the name of it.
Okay. And then, what did you use for frames? Were you building little wooden frames, or did you get...
Yeah, I made my own frames.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, I was one of these guys that just hung around boats enough until I saw what people were doing, and
yeah,
and I built them on the cheap. So what I I made them out of 2x6s and.
And that was very common. That was very common. The commercial, I mean, Moki Mac, a lot of commercial operators were running wooden frames at that time.
Oh, yeah, everybody was doing them.
And then for the oars, what kind of oars did you use? Where'd you get those?
Well, I had a lot of fun with oars. The first oars I made myself, I made them out of muffler pipe.
Oh, wow.
And I put I would put a slot in the end of the tube and put a paddle in there, a plywood paddle. And I got on the river, and I didn't make it to Phantom Ranch when I had broken almost all my paddles.
Right. Okay.
So I had to come up with something else. Then I learned about a place in Maine, of all places, that made ash oars.
Okay.
And, you know, this is back in the old days when things were cheap. And I could buy these things for about $20 a piece, and I got a whole bunch of them.
Huh.
And they lasted me the rest of my career.
Okay.
Yeah, this is the thing that's really fun about this was I never had any training. I went on a couple of trips. George took me on a couple of trips. He was running motor boats. He was running S-rigs, the biggest ones they got. And, I was just going along for the ride.
Right.
And all I'm doing is watching. Now I got a couple of rafts.
Right.
And I got to get on a river and get a little experience. So in 1976, I got a graduate student. We were going to make our first run through the Grand Canyon. The only place that I had run a raft was on the North Fork of the Platte River west of Laramie. And it's a nice run, but I mean it's a little river. So we had to get a little experience. So we had all the equipment loaded in a truck I had, and we stopped at Westwater on the Colorado-Utah line and ran Westwater for our first initiation.
All right.
And we got in there, and it was really running hot, and we got to the big rapid in the middle of the thing.
Which is Skull.
Skull, yeah. And I was merrily going through Skull, Boy, I turned that boat straight up in the air. I thought it was going over.
Oh, no.
And, but we landed, I landed back on the water and pulled it out the other end. And that was the training trip for the Grand Canyon.
Okay. And so this would have been the Grand Canyon River trip in the spring of 76?
Yeah, 76.
Okay.
Would have been in June.
All right, June. Who was on that river trip?
Me and a guy named Keith. Keith, I gotta think of his last name. Anyway, there's just two of us, me and a graduate student. He was in one boat and I was in the other.
Okay, and Keith was a U of A grad?
He was a University of Wyoming.
Oh.
Keith Thompson.
Okay.
And that was a very interesting trip. I had really good luck. I ran two trips in 1976 and never flipped a boat.
And
talk
so you,
about beginner's luck.
Well, that's not unusual.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're cautious and you're slow and you scout and you check things out, and you know you got an 18-foot boat, which was probably pretty fully loaded, and I'm assuming these were 18-day long trips or longer.
Actually, we were really pushing. I was usually getting through in 11 days.
Oh wow.
Were
cranking.
But these were long days. You know, when you only got a couple of people,
right?
You can have 14-hour days, and it's not a problem. And I'm not cooking for folks like the commercial guys,
right?
So you know, all the time is going into the field work.
So in 76, was the river doing its up to 30,000 in the day and down to 6,000 at night, up and down yo-yo like that?
Yeah, but it wasn't quite getting up into the 30s.
Okay.
I was running the big stuff around 10 to 15, maybe 10 to 12.
Okay.
But at night it was going out, so, you know, our boats would be hung up on the rocks in the morning and in the eastern Grand Canyon for the low flows. It was a pain.
Right.
So you quickly learn how to get around that, but we were riding those awful fluctuations.
Okay, and so when the water's high, you can cruise along pretty fast.
You can make good time.
So that 11 days, but so were you going through just to observe and look at stuff as you rode by, or did you actually want to get out and walk around and go look at stuff?
We'd have to dock and hike up the canyons and see what we wanted.
Okay.
And what I was looking for were, I was looking for information that I could build into cross sections of these fault zones to show what they were doing mechanically to the rocks.
Okay.
So I had to do a lot of hiking, but not, you know, not great distances from the river.
Okay.
But, you know, the problem I have always had in my career working in the Grand Canyon was when I could access the place was always in the summer, which is the last time you want to be in
stinking
there.
Stinking hot.
Yeah, and, you know, with global warming now, the temperatures are getting worse.
Yep.
I just couldn't imagine working down there in the temperatures they have now, which are consistently over 100 degrees.
Yeah. Yep.
And I was sitting at it. We did a couple of days like that every season. But that, working in the Grand Canyon, you want to do it in the fall and the spring, and I never had that opportunity.
Yeah. So two trips in 76. Did you run again in the 70s later?
I ran lots of trips.
Okay. And did you slow down? Did you run longer trips?
No, they were pretty much the same length.
Okay.
And my luck ran out, had a few flips, you know.
Well, tell me about your first flip. Where were you? What were you doing? How'd that happen?
Well, let's see. I don't know which one was the first. I'll tell you where I had great flips. One was in Crystal, of course, and that was late. I didn't flip in Crystal until many years later.
Like the 1980s?
Yeah, it was in the 80s. I was going down there, and there was I had two or three people on a boat with me. And as you know, the way you cheated Crystal was you pulled over far right and tried to bounce down along the shore there until you got past a critical wave.
Yeah.
And then you could pull out, and you'd go by the big stuff.
Yeah.
And I made kind of a perfect run there. And I came out, and I just wasn't lined up right, and we got in the heavy stuff. And that boat went over so fast, I was still sitting in the seat upside down.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, I never had a flip where I cleared the boat. I was always stuck under the boat. So I had to find my way out. And, you know, that's not... In those boats, that's kind of an anxiety because you're afraid you're going to get tangled up in the ropes and all that.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, I bounced out, and then I rode through the rock garden below the Crystal because it was low enough water. I had to bounce through the rocks there before I could get back to the raft.
Oops.
And unfortunately, my passengers got thrown clear, and they had nice, clean swims, no sweat.
Hmm.
The first time when I was running in the 70s, Crystal was still really big. Even it flows like 11,000. It was big.
Okay.
And everybody hated going to Crystal. Well, one day I was going into Crystal. I had a guy named Henry Richter in my boat with me. He was the only guy in the boat with me. And Henry was the kind of guy, he was a real adventurer. He wanted to sit right on the front to get the best ride. So I'm in the driver's seat. He's sitting on the front, and we pull into Crystal. Well, we do the same thing, pull over far to the right, and we're just hitting the rocks on the right. There's a wave that stacked up that was parallel to the rocks. You would ride the boat up on that wave, keeping it centered off to the right side, and you would slide off it and go around the big stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I made the perfect run up on that wave, and I was real proud of myself, and I don't know what happened, but that boat just slid left. And there I was, heading straight for the hole. And Henry's looking at the hole coming up at it. Well, we were looking into the hole. The hole just looked like it was... You know, it looked like we were going over.
Going to eat you alive. Yeah.
But, of course, it wasn't that bad. Mm. But the tongue going into the hole is, I don't know if you ever saw it, but it was just smooth as glass. It was beautiful. And, you know, it was about 30 or so feet wide, and it was just smooth as glass. And in front of my boat, about probably 30 feet, was a patch of foam that was about 3 feet in diameter. And I was watching that foam go down into the hole. And, you know, I'm watching it because I want to see what's going to happen to it,
right,
because I'm going there. And the foam rode up on the upstream side of the wave on the bottom of the hole, and all of a sudden it haystacked and just blew out, and we got splashed by it. And I thought, boy, if it haystacks like that, we're going over.
Right.
Well, anyway, our boat rode up that thing. We got to the top of the wave. The wave just sheared off and went down the river. My boat slid over the top, and we rode out the bottom of the rapid, and I didn't have but 2 buckets of water in that boat.
Wow.
I still can't believe that I got away with it like that.
Cool.
Yeah, you know, that's just one of those wonderful things that happens to you.
And it's so funny because you have 6 boats all lined up, and they all make the same run, and the first boat flips, and the fifth boat flips, and the third boat and the sixth boat have a dry run. You know, it's like, well, it's just this.
Yeah, it's just luck of the draw.
Yeah, fascinating, fascinating hydraulics that munch you or don't.
Yeah.
Huh, how lovely. Very cool.
Well, the good thing, there is a benefit for flipping a boat, and that is that if you're wearing a life jacket, you live and you realize that you can survive these things.
Yeah.
That makes it a little more tolerant.
It's all practice. It's all training.
Yeah.
The more you do it, the more comfortable you get with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's lovely. I want to go back to Nebraska because you only were there for 4 years. How did you get out of that?
Well, while I was there, I was, of course, trying to see if I could go west again.
Okay.
And on the fourth year that I was there, I went out to the University of Wyoming to visit Jim Sears, our mapping partner from the Grand Canyon map.
Yep.
And that was when he was a graduate student at the University of Wyoming. And I got there late 1 week, and I ran into the head of the department, the geology department, a guy named Robert Houston. And he and I started talking. Well, he'd been thinking about hydrology, groundwater hydrology, as a good opportunity for them to get into. So they were looking for a faculty member in that, and we started talking. And he encouraged me to consider Wyoming and asked me to apply. And so I applied to there, and they got me a job. So I was out of Nebraska in 76, I think. Oh wait, when was it? I was there for 4 years, 78. Wait, no, 74. It was 74 when I got out of Nebraska and came over to Wyoming.
Okay. So
I spent 24 years at Wyoming.
Oh, wow. Okay. And that's, what is that, Jackson? What's the town?
Oh, the town is Laramie. It's
Laramie.
In the southeast corner of the state.
Okay.
At 7,200 feet.
Ooh.
Yeah, so it's cold.
Cold, snow, yeah.
8 months of winter.
Wow. Not like Tucson.
No, but it was a big improvement from the flatlands in the Grand.
And so you basically started the hydrology department there.
Well, I had a groundwater program. It was very small.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a one-man groundwater program. But I can't really say that. I had terrific faculty support. Had great geochemistry there.
Okay.
A guy named Drever was there, and he was a leading geochemist. So any students we had got a really good education there.
Okay.
And I ran about 1 or 2 or 3 graduate students a summer there.
Cool. Okay. And did you bring your computer model along? And were you doing computer modeling of the aquifers there?
I actually left that stuff behind in Nebraska. When I moved to Wyoming, for a time, I had a split position between their Water Resources Center and the Geology Department.
Okay.
And while I was working for the Water Resources Center, the head of that really liked this digital modeling stuff, and he had me write a manual on how to do it, and they published that.
Oh.
But that was the end of that stuff for me. I never made a model in Wyoming, and frankly, I was kind of glad to graduate from it.
Cool.
I got into
okay.
other stuff that was more interesting to me.
Okay. All right. Well, we've been going about 50 minutes here. Maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this oral history series. What do you think?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Anything else you want to add about the material that we've covered here?
No, that's we did a better job today.
Oh, good. All right. Well, with that, let's conclude part 6 of our Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Peter Huntoon. Today is Sunday, October 1st, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Peter, thank you so very much.
Okay.